I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. Rag Radio comes your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. On Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin, which is a cooperatively run, solar-powered, all-volunteer community radio station. We're also rebroadcast by a number of other radio stations in other parts of the country. Our podcasts are put up at the Internet Archive and at the Rag Blog, and they have legs. They go all over the place, and lots of people listen to this show. We have an international audience. I don't know how big it is. You know, there's somebody in Germany, and there's somebody in, and there's somebody who used to be in Germany. But we have a fun show scheduled today. I wanted to say hey to Tracy Schultz. Tracy?
Hey, how's it going?
Hey. Tracy's very good at saying hey. Roger Baker is here taking pictures, our regular crew. And my guest is rock and roll historian Ed Ward, author of The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 through 1963. Ed is the rock historian on NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross. He worked with South by Southwest from its founding, and he is the author of this recently published book, which we will discuss on today's show. Ward has done commentary on Fresh Air for the last 35 years, reaching 14 million listeners. He's also the co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He has contributed to the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and was on the staff of Crawdaddy, Rolling Stone, and Cream, the cream of the early rock and roll crop there, and the three of them, as well as the Austin American Statesman and the Austin Chronicle. He blogs at City on a Hill, and Ed was previously our guest on Rag Radio on November 7th, 2014. About the book, I love this. Ed Ward covers the first half of a history of rock and roll in this sweeping and definitive narrative from the 1920s, when the music of rambling medicine shows mingled with the songs of vaudeville and minstrel acts to create the very early sounds of country and rhythm and blues, to the rise of the first independent record labels post-World War II and concluding in December 1963, just as an immense change in the airwaves took hold and the Beatles prepared for their first American tour. Steve Nathans-Kelly says that that Ed Ward excels at identifying the defining moments in music history through small stories that make up the larger narrative. So there. All true?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, thanks for being
with
us.
Sounds good anyway.
Thanks for being with us again, Ed. It's always so much fun. And I think this book, I love the book. The book is very, very cool, and I can't wait for part two.
Yeah, well, you're going to have to, so try to contain your enthusiasm a bit.
Oh, dude, man. Okay, it's contained. I want to start out before we get into the book, because with the book, I just want you to kind of go through the narrative. Obviously, you can't cover everything, but you can tell some of the stories, and you can talk about some of the influences that came together, some of the threads that happened, because the history of rock and roll is not just a simple narrative. It's a wonderful, complex web of development. But first, you worked with, like I said, some of the most important music magazines in the country. You've been involved in the music world for a long time. What got you involved in that? Were you interested in music as a kid?
I was listening to the radio. You know, I'm like the girl in Lou Reed's song, One Fine Day. I heard a New York station and my life was changed by rock and roll, which was, you know, inevitable because New York had some of the most diverse radio. It had, you know, at one point it had three rock and roll stations, which if you didn't like what one was playing, you could go to the other. And if your tolerance extended, as most people's did, to rhythm and blues, there were another two or three stations. There was one that from New Jersey that didn't come in too well. But, you know, there were, you basically had five stations that you could rock out to.
And this was when?
I traced my first record purchase back to, I think, October 1957.
This is a historian, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, no, what it was, I got curious, and I had a book of charts, you know, the top tens and so forth. And I know what the first record I bought was. It was Honeycomb by Jimmy Rogers. And I also know that I shortly thereafter bought At the Hop by Danny and the Juniors. And so I just sort of triangulated that with the fact that there was a new kid in my school class in third grade, I believe it was. And he's the guy who, you know, nobody was talking to him, just like nobody was talking to me. So he invited me over to his house after school, and we went into his sister's room and played a bunch of these 45 records that she had. He said, you know, it was a good idea for us to have an interest in this because his brother had a motorcycle and he was going to be a rock, which is, I guess, a fairly regional term. He was planning to be a juvenile delinquent or something. I don't know. They were essentially rich Jewish kids, and they weren't exactly like the majority of kids I was going to school with.
Like the majority of juvenile delinquents, although that might not be true.
Right? Well, you know, there was a lot of the kids in my school were of Italian descent. Some were actual Italians who had come over to work for the local businessmen's association, as it were. And they were really hardcore. And as far as the music was concerned, they were hardcore about that too. It was a way to find something of a community, which actually rock and roll was very big at pulling. I was young, you know, for an average rock and roll fan, but you know, everybody was getting interested in sports, and I was trying to decide which of the three Major League Baseball teams to root for in New York, and then the one I decided on moved to Los Angeles.
Yeah, they did.
Thanks, Dodgers. And so I thought, well, you know, I have this capacity to get all this data in my head, so I just turned it into, you know, following records as they went up and down the charts. I had no idea what I was listening to. But eventually, I did get it a little more figured out.
But you were interested in the records. You were interested in the written record. I mean, not the records that you play. I mean, the written record, the lists. Which is kind of a good way to start being a historian.
Well,
in some ways,
and everybody was really into what's number one and so forth. And
right.
Have you heard this new record? It just broke into the top 10, and you know, out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So that was happening a lot, and a lot of the stuff I didn't like. I mean, Elvis just scared me. I couldn't figure out what he was doing, but I was really into singing, you know, church choir and stuff, and so all those black vocal group records made a great deal of sense to me, and I once again I didn't realize that what I was hearing was very, very regional. A lot of the records I liked the best were by groups from New York City, and they were born, raised, and recorded in New York City. And there was a whole nother scene happening in Chicago and a whole nother scene in Los Angeles, just speaking about black vocal groups.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where were you trained? Were you trained in journalism at all or in cultural history or anything like that? Or
no.
Was it just you just moved in that direction?
I'm one of these people who will read pretty much anything I can stick in front of my nose. I'm most of the way through a 700-page history of the Middle Ages at the moment, just because I'm getting interested in a more detailed fashion in that subject.
Yeah. Of course, I'm not trained in anything either. So.
Yeah, I mean,
formally, officially.
No,
acting.
There was a incident in. I read so much stuff as a kid, and one of the things I read was The Adventures of Dobie Gillis, because the writer lived near where we did. And, you know, it was in the paper some.
Yeah.
So I started reading Dobie Gillis, and there's this scene where he goes to college, and he's talking to the dean, and the dean is saying, well, I've signed you up for course on Byzantine history, metallurgy, underwater basket weaving, and ping pong for your physical education. And Dobie goes, well, what am I going to do with all that? I want to be a writer. And the dean goes, son, with a bunch of courses like that, there's nothing else you can be.
I love W. Gillis. I, of course, the cool thing is to say, man, who I really love was Maynard G. Krebs.
Yeah, but he's not in the books.
He's not in the books, yeah. So, but he was a nice addition to the television series. Anyway, I love that. I thought they did a nice job with the television series.
Oh, yeah.
It had a sweet sensibility to it. So, okay, tell me this. Let's jump to the cosmic. Obviously, there's been a lot of trends in our society, cultural trends that have affected us in dramatic ways. Is there anything that's affected us more dramatically than rock and roll, or that's become, or that was more transformative?
Well, sure, lots of things. Well, but rock and roll was the perfect metaphor for after the war, when people were going, well, now what? We have a lot of money and we have a lot of jobs and we got, you know, we want to spend money on entertainment and we give our kids allowances, and now the kids suddenly have money. And there was a whole bunch of shocked marketing studies in the early and mid-50s about just how much money these teenagers have. In fact, I mean, I have always said that the teenager was invented in post-war America. I was wrong. John Savage, who is a wonderful writer in England, has a big fat book called Teenage, which essentially stops in 1951. Mm-hmm. And so I no longer believe that. But in the United States, the fact that there were teenagers who identified themselves as such, and they weren't really being served by entertainment. They were still being treated as large children. They didn't outgrow their clothing as fast as a three-year-old does, but they were not young adults, not until they went to college. And in high school, you know, you got your raging hormones and you got your need to have a personal brand of expression. Right. And that's what happened through rock and roll. Initially, because white kids heard black music on the radio and they wanted it, and they would go seek it out in, you know, record stores that were not really there to cater to them. What's interesting is a lot of the early rock and roll and a lot of the pre-rock and roll popular music, the black popular music, wasn't intended for teenagers at all. It was intended for adults.
It's rock and roll, and to a great extent, its antecedents were really all about, you know, lifestyle, and in addition to being about music, unlike say the classical music traditions, which were for audiences,
and they had a different social function.
Right.
Very little of what we know as classical music, anyway, was performed as either entertainment or social music.
Okay, I just want to talk briefly about Fresh Air, and then I want to get into the history. I love Fresh Air, and Terry Gross is one of my favorite interviewers in the world.
Right.
I just think she's delightful and terrific, as good as anybody out there. 35 years is a long tenure,
yeah,
to be involved with with something like that, which is, I mean, not only is she good, but the show itself is one of the quality shows on radio. What has that experience been like?
Well, you know, it's good that I no longer have to produce a show, or I don't produce it, but I don't have to write a show every week. They put me on when they've got a hole big enough for something they've got in the can. And so it's forced me to seek out continuously strange corners. I don't do a piece, you know, I know what it was. It was a friend of mine, who's a publicist, who just was trying to hype me on doing something on the Rolling Stones albums coming out in mono. And I said, Bob, I need a story. I can't just say these albums are out in mono for 7 minutes. I can't do it.
Okay. What are we doing? Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio, and my guest is Ed Ward, rock and roll historian and the author of The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1. It covers 1920 to 1963. That date was chosen because that's the year I graduated from high school. So
1920?
There you go. I love the way you develop the story. It's like a detective novel in some ways. I mean, it's very...
Except I know how the story ends.
Yeah, so. Yeah, and that's cheating, of course.
Yeah.
But what do they call it? There's spoilers involved. But how did you decide how to structure it?
Well, there is a certain linear transition, and once the main subject, which is rock and roll music for teenagers, becomes established, the easiest thing to do was just year by year. I don't think I'll be following that format in the second volume because it wouldn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
There will be still a progression in time, but it may jump back and forth some.
Yeah, but this is about the narrative, about the continuity, and as opposed to being about a section about this artist and a section about that artist, which is
absolutely not a great man theory of history here, because that's the way it's always been done, and it's led to such idiotic misconceptions as Elvis beginning rock and roll by walking into Sun Records, right. And for the first time, a white man fused country music and black music, like Bob Wills never existed, or Jimmy Rogers,
for that matter, yeah.
Or Ed Giovanuti and Eddie Lang,
Yeah. Okay, I think we're going to take a break. I'm Thorne Dreyer, Rag Radio. We're talking with Ed Ward, Tracy Schultz. You ready for it? Okay, that's Little Richard. I'm Thorne Dreyer. Ed Ward's my guest on Rag Radio. Important song there?
Oh, yeah. This is the song that everybody always wants to know, what was the first rock and roll song? And obviously there is no answer to that. But what I decided was the drumming on Tutti Frutti by Earl Palmer was the template for all of the rock stuff that came later. It wasn't as swinging. It wasn't as syncopated as even Hound Dog or, Good Rockin' Tonight, all those things. That's a style of drumming that eventually comes out of swing. And rock and roll mostly now is just, it's metronomic, There isn't that much swing to it, which is why when there was a swing revival beginning in the 1970s, it was such a revelation to so many people's ears.
Ed Ward is the author of The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 to 1963. You didn't write the book using the great man theory or whatever you wrote, but Little Richard?
Well, he was a great man, but he was one in a series.
Yes, but he played an incredibly seminal role. don't you think?
Well, you know, he was somebody who was very specifically aiming himself at teenagers.
Right.
Because the rhythm and blues audience thought, well, they knew who he was. I mean, they knew he was, you know, he played gay bars and he was very flamboyant. And they, you know, they, since he wasn't in gospel, you could get away with that stuff in gospel. In fact, all of that woo that he does in that song actually it's comes gospel. To us from, I just forgot his name, a very famous gospel singer. Who wound up as the musical director of the Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem.
Oh.
I wanted to say Julius Cheeks, but it isn't Julius Cheeks. It'll come to
It'll
me.
Come.
Anyway, he had that
when
exact
it comes,
same
just
thing.
Just throw it out there.
Yeah, I mean, that's. I mean, his biggest hit was called, Too Close. I'm too close to heaven to stop now. And he's always shrieking. He does it about four or five times in that song. And you know, it was a gigantic hit as far as gospel goes.
Right, right.
But you know, the people like Chuck Berry, it was teenagers buying those records. It was not adult African Americans. They had other people that they were listening to. And the teenagers were also listening to. But Richard and Chuck Berry were kind of beyond the pale as far as that was concerned. And there aren't very many other performers who were that wild and successful. You know, there was Billy Lee Riley and his little green men and other rockabilly weirdos.
Right.
But they weren't very successful.
Okay. Before we go back, because I want to talk about the various influences and ranging from ragtime to blues to... When was that teenage audience the market? How did that come about?
Well, I think it came about from kids recognizing each other. People always want to put it onto Alan Freed up there in Cleveland, but even before then, there were on the Clear Channel stations, you know, out of Tennessee, you could hear Randy's Record Shop and people like that sponsoring rhythm and blues shows, one-hour shows. But they were Clear Channel stations in that there was nothing else around on that frequency. And, you know, Bob Dylan, growing up in rural Minnesota, used to tune into those to those stations. And so did many, many, many other people.
Right.
And so those sponsored shows also had the ability to, you could send them money and they would mail you a package of records. And the cheaper the package was, the more random what you were going to get was. You know, five hit records including, and they would name two of them, and the other three were just things they were trying to get out of stock because they weren't selling.
Okay, but is there something that we might, because you know the music that we have queued up because you suggested it. Is there something we might play right now that would kick us off into the beginning of the narrative?
Well, no, not really. I didn't put anything
well,
down.
Well, but
what
would be a good thing to good because I'd like to play something now. I don't think you can go too long talking about rock and roll without.
Yeah, that's true. If I were to choose something for the very beginning, I would probably go for Crazy Blues by Mamie Smith, which is the 1920 record that I started the book, because you have to start with a date or else people get upset.
Right.
And
well, we do have the Five Royals.
But that's 1957, so that's like well into.
But let's play that anyway.
Well, no, I was thinking, how about Good Rockin' Tonight?
Oh, Good Rockin'
Tonight.
Yeah, let's get a little play of that.
I heard the news,
Okay, Edward, tell us about it.
Well, that's Wynonie Harris, who was a great blues shouter in the rhythm and blues world, the post-war rhythm and blues world. He came out of a big band as their vocalist and went and recorded just dozens and dozens of terrible records for Bess Berman at Apollo Records in Harlem, and he was very, very popular because he was very handsome. He was over 6 feet tall. He wasn't big and fat like a lot of the blues shouters, and you know, women just went wild about him. But man, his records were terrible, and so he
dang it.
he got signed to King Records in Cincinnati, and they had a guy there named Henry Glover who knew how to pick good songs. So that's half of the story of that song. Now, the other half of it is, it was written by a guy named Roy Brown, who was in New Orleans. And he was an amateur singer. He sang in bars, you know, small bands backing him up. And he wrote this song. He thought, you know who would do a great job on this is Wynonie Harris. So when Harris came through town, Roy Brown tried to get to him. And Wynonie's manager wouldn't let him near him. He says, but I've got a song for you. Yeah, people say that all the time. Get lost, kid. So Roy ran into a guy who had a big hit in Los Angeles. In fact, it's another one of those first rock and roll records back when he was in the Army. Man, I'm fishing for his name. Well, anyway, he was also coming through town, and Roy said, man, I really wish I could get this song to Wynonie Harris. And so the guy says, oh, sing me some of it. He did, and the guy was so impressed that he called up the record company he was currently recording for at 3 in the morning, got the guy out of bed, and he said, listen to this. And Roy sang the song into the phone, and the guy said, okay, let's get this recorded. So he recorded it, and it went to Deluxe Records, which was a subsidiary of King. And they put it out, and Roy Brown had this smash hit with it, and Wynonie Harris says, why didn't I get that record? And somebody had to tell him. So he went and recorded it and got an even bigger hit because he was Wynonie Harris. He was well known. Cecil Gant, that was the name of the guy who, so-called private Cecil Gant.
Isn't it interesting how much serendipity there is to all of this?
Oh, yeah.
And how much getting together someone who knew how to record and knew the right stuff to record in terms of the career, somebody's career.
I wouldn't say that most of the guys who owned these labels knew what they were doing. Yeah. They just had some money and saw a way to make more money with a very little outlay of cash. They didn't signed contract, or they had contracts, but there was no money to the contract as they, for signing. You don't get a $20,000 signing bonus or something on these labels. You get a deal, and if you don't have hits, they cut you loose. And you don't keep your publishing, you don't keep your royalties from mechanical rights, anything. You record, you get paid a little bit, then you go on the road, then you record some more, you get paid a little bit, blah blah blah,
right?
And so that's what it was. There are very, very few people who were actual fans of one or another kinds of music. Art Roop, who founded Specialty Records in the late 1940s in Los Angeles, had he'd been Arthur Rubinstein, and he'd moved from Pittsburgh to Los Angeles because he could be sure he could hear his favorite kind of music, which was gospel music. He was like some weird white Jewish gospel fan from Pittsburgh and started up Specialty Records because gospel was his specialty. But he kept getting rhythm and blues people walking through the door, you know, Mr. Roop, please record me. And so, you know, he finally hired people to help him do that. I mean, Bumps Blackwell, who was the guy that he made listen to Little Richard's mailed-in tape, and in Los Angeles, the guy who did his talent scouting was Sonny Bono. And so, you know, these people went, they knew, they had roots in the black community, and they knew what, who was who in the clubs and so forth. So he could lean on them. But Roop also knew what he was hearing when he heard these records, which is something you can't really say for Sid Nathan at King. Now, you also have the Chess Brothers in Chicago, and they knew what they were doing because they, from their father's liquor store in the South Side, they opened up a bar, and they noticed that none of the people who were drawing crowds to the bar had records out. So they went to an already existing record label called Aristocrat, which was owned by a woman and her husband, and they convinced them that they knew what they were doing, so they put out a couple records, and they sold much better than anything on Aristocrat, so the Chess Brothers bought them out and renamed the label Chess.
Uh-huh.
And that was, you know, Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
Was, well, he wasn't the, he was playing on the record that was the big hit. Interestingly enough, Muddy already had a contract with Columbia Records, and he had made a recording with them where you can not even really hear him playing, but the recording session was supervised by a longtime record company veteran who had been the guy who had Paramount Records sign blues recording artists back in the 1920s.
Wow.
And he was from Chicago, and just he saw a way to make himself some money. So he walked up to Wisconsin, which is where the Paramount Records people were, and convinced them that colored people had money and wanted to buy records and record players, because it was a furniture company.
Yeah.
And he was right.
Speaking of which, of course, the development of the record player, the phonograph, played a major role in the evolution.
Well, it commercialized music.
Right.
And that is where the story really starts.
I love it. Okay.
Otherwise, it's folk music.
Ed Ward is the rock and roll historian on Fresh Air, National Public Radio. He's also the author of The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 to 1963. And in the book, you begin Chapter Zero by saying, in mid-19th century rural South America, which is as good a place as any to start this story.
Southern America, not South America.
Southern America, sorry. Thank you very much. So anyway, as any place to start the, or rather, it could have been just one of the things you did if you did it, like smoking hams, mending the roof and the fences, and hoeing the vegetable patch. Black or white, northern or southern, rural life consisted of one job after another just to stay alive. Sometimes, particularly among African Americans, music accompanied work, as it also did among sailors or excavating crews. Field hollers may have been, and then we go on. Talk to us a little bit about the beginnings.
Well, the beginnings are, as I say, the beginning of the record industry. When, you know, the Dinwiddie Colored Quintet, recorded Edison cylinders, and the Fisk University Jubilee Singers, who were the largest selling or the largest box office black group in the world. Command performances for Queen Victoria in London and so forth. And this began the process of getting white ears accustomed to black musical structure, things like, you know, the blue note thing and so forth. And the Fisk Jubilee Singers, I mean, their arrangements were so genteel and smooth, but they shocked everybody nonetheless with their weird harmonies, they said.
Right, right.
And but, I mean, God, I think the Fisks were still going in the 1950s. I'm not sure when the actual, you know, lineage died out. And they also inspired a lot of other groups, some of whom actually were fundraising for their colleges, others of which were not. Especially the ones that went to Europe, because who knew from black colleges in Europe? And so there's all these Jubilee Singers who were just entertainers.
Right.
But getting that down to where the example I like is where you have Eck Dunford and Henry C. Gilliland, who had just won a fiddle contest in Virginia, and with the money and dressed in their Confederate and Union uniforms, took the train up to New York and walked into RCA and said, "We just won us a contest. Record us." And for some unknown reason, RCA did. And that's the beginning of country music, because that they put it out as, you know, hillbilly novelty or something, and it sold. But what's also important is those two guys not only represented opposite sides in the Civil War, they were two separate fiddle styles, one from Virginia and one from Texas. Eck Dunford played UT folk festivals in the 60s, well into his 80s or maybe even 90s. He was a real virtuoso fiddler in the Texas style, but not in the Virginia style. But the fact is that they both knew tunes. Arkansas Traveler is one of the ones they did, and I forget what the other side of the record was. But that was their, you know, they knew these tunes, they could play them together, and...
And then how did they do that? How did the styles mix, and what was the end result?
They just said, let's play Arkansas Traveler.
And they just played it in their own way.
So, you know, one guy plays the melody and low harmonization, and the other guy, and while they play, you know, chords, the other guy plays chords, and one guy's playing the melody. They switched it back and forth.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guest is Ed Ward, and we're having a blast. Take it, Tracy.
man, don't fade that.
Oh, fade back up.
No, no, it's over.
Yeah, that was the last licks of the guitar there.
You faded that amazing feedback extravaganza at the end of the song.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's like that's kind of new. Was that kind of new at the time? It's like
nobody was playing guitar like that at the time. I mean, you know, B.B. King was playing his own variation on that, but that was Loman Pauling, who came out of nowhere. Well, not nowhere, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. The Five Royales, who started out as a gospel group recording once again for Apollo Records in Harlem. But she had Bess Berman had a clause in the contract that if you weren't doing well selling gospel, she had the right to ask you to record secular music. And her biggest star was Mahalia Jackson, and she refused, and so Bess cut her loose. The Royal Sons Quintet from Winston-Salem said, yeah. And so they recorded a bunch of stuff, but it wasn't until 1957 when Henry Glover at King Records, which had signed the Five Royales, allowed them to use their own guitar player, who was also their main songwriter, Loman Pete Pauling, that they really had this sound. Now, that was not a hit. That was a B-side. Even with all that spectacular guitar playing, very few people have heard that record even today.
Yeah, but I was going to say, it's like it's kind of new to me, but that guitar riff, it's like that's fiery. There's a lot of folks that are trying to play like that now.
I know. What happened was that Pauling influenced a lot of guitar players. The one that mostly people know about is Steve Cropper from Booker T and the MGs, and also one of the great soul music guitar players of all time. Steve went and saw them at some auditorium in Memphis, and he went home and he took the belt off of his pants and augmented his guitar strap with it so that he could play down low like Loman did. Huh. And he said that changed everything. Loman Pauling changed everything for him. The sort of gospel guitar style that broke out into a fiery lead, and you can hear this on their one of their big hits was Think. The original version has him all over it. You can hear it on his on their original recording of Dedicated to the One I Love, because there's these snaky little strange guitar interludes there which got lost with the Shirelles and of course the Mamas and Papas, both of whom had much, much bigger hits than the Five Royales did with it. Oh, wow.
Okay, what about Elvis, other than that he scared you when you were a kid? What was how important really was he?
Well, he was important because he was unlike Richard, who was a dangerous black guy, Elvis seemed to be a dangerous white guy, but wasn't. That was just it. Once the microphone was pointed at him by the interviewer, he said, sir.
He was all yes, sir, and no, sir.
Yeah, and sir, ma'am. He talked about his mother and how much he loved his mother and going to church with her. And so here was this kid that other kids could check out and go, he seems to be dangerous, but he's not. But he makes cool music. And so there was yet another member of the tribe discovered down in Memphis. Of course, he was always going to stay there, except for the fact that they started playing his records in Texas. He broke out of Dallas.
Oh, wow.
That was the beginning of his. There was a woman there who did promotion, independent promotion for tiny labels, and she picked this up and said, you know, I think you got something here. And she worked for a record distributor in Dallas, got it onto the Dallas pop station as well as country. And then that spread to Houston. And the next thing you know, he was doing a tour of Texas, which ended up in Lubbock, where Buddy Holly went to see him and walked up to him in between sets. Elvis was sitting alone, you know, in the bar drinking a Coke, and Buddy walked up to him. He said, hi, I really like your stuff. And Elvis was, as usual, worried about some imperfection that he had just committed. Oh, I don't know. And so Buddy and Bob Montgomery, who was his performing partner at the time, they said, well, come on, let me show you around Lubbock. And Elvis had a date the next afternoon playing on a flatbed truck in front of a car dealership opening. And so they spent some of the day running around. And they were, you know, Elvis really dug that. He thought, wow, there's another kid like me. And, of course, Buddy was thinking, wow, there's another kid like me. And so two great careers, you know, starting up there. Next time Elvis came through, he was in a bus, and he saw Buddy and Bob driving down the highway. They were coming into Lubbock, and he honked the horn on the bus and had him pull over and ran out of the bus and into the back of their car and said, let's go.
Okay, how important was Texas?
Initially, not very important. The thing that you need, well, especially back in the mid-50s and early 60s, you need someplace you can record, and you need people who know how to record you. You also need enough talent so that if you need a piano player, you can find one who can play that kind of style. This is not a problem in Memphis. This is not a problem in Los Angeles. This is a huge problem in Big Spring.
Yeah, I guess. But it's interesting because you had, you know, from Bob Wills to Mance Lipscomb, who I think was very, very important.
He had
so much talent. But
he wasn't that important initially because he never recorded. This is, once again, this is my thing about folk music. If somebody hadn't pulled Mance off of that farm and recorded him, Chris Strachwitz had not followed, Mac McCormick's advice and gone to Navasota and recorded Mance, he would have been folk music. Who knows how many guys played guitar really well and had a great repertoire of songs who died unheard.
And how important were people like Chris Strachwitz and
well, that's, you know, the folk music.
John Lomax.
That's not rock and roll.
Okay, but wasn't there a lot of overlap or not? Am I wrong?
No, not really. Not until you get the white kids picking up
folk rock.
Folk music, not even folk rock. I'm talking about post-Kingston Trio stuff in like 1958, and Bob Dylan and Joan Baez emerging onto the scene. That's when folk music became important, and it becomes really important in the mid-60s as people, well, like Roger McGuinn, Jim McGuinn as he was then, at the Troubadour, which is a musician's hangout, in Los Angeles, getting on stage, opening for whatever folk act was playing that evening, and his set was half Beatles songs played on a 12-string guitar. And that was shocking. That was just like, how can you do that? Because don't you know any folk music? Well, of course he did. Everybody knows folk music. They came to see something interesting, was the way he felt about it. And so he was kind of this star among other musicians because he was doing that. But, you know, the folk revival, yeah, it was important, but mostly in terms of democratizing the idea of playing. You know, once, if you had a guitar, you could sing folk songs with your friends. You could have a hootenanny, you know, or you could learn songs that you could play from folk music magazines and records.
Okay, Tracy, let's play. We have something more to play, don't we?
Well, we got a couple of songs that are still queued up. We have yet to get to Dick Dale and the Beach Boys.
Let's try Dick Dale because that feeds into what I was just saying.
Okay, cool.
Okay, let's give it a little lick.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a song called Let's Go Trippin' by Dick Dale. It's a great pick. It's like something I'm not necessarily familiar with. But I know him.
That was his first record. And okay. It came about because he was this huge attraction in Balboa Beach in Los Angeles. Or not Los Angeles, south of Los Angeles. Quite near where the Beach Boys were growing up. And he had always been a musician. His real name was Mansour, and he was Lebanese. His family owned Lebanese restaurants, and they had Arabic music in them, and he was playing the bouzouki and learned the bouzouki as a teenager. But he was very, very fond of surfing and opened a music store in Balboa Beach and sold Fender equipment, because Fender was also very near where he was in an industrial park. And Leo Fender saw this guy selling loads of Fender equipment in his store and used him to test some of his new designs, including the reverb, the Fender reverb amp, which was, that was the sound of surf music. Dick Dale held dances with this rock and roll band. He had the Deltones, and the thing that got the kids going the most was playing the Surfer Stomp. Now, this is a really metronomic record, because there's no syncopation at all. It's, you know, you can hear it claw, claw, and that's the famous Surfer Stomp, because these guys would get so drunk, the only thing they could do would stomp on one foot and then the other and rock back and forth. It wasn't, you know, ballroom dancing. But the thing is,
it wasn't highly choreographed.
Right, but by this time, the guitars that Fender was trying to sell, which weren't they weren't acoustic at all. They were the first one he designed. He called the plank, because that's what it was. It was a plank with a guitar neck on it and a pickup coil and six strings, just to show that you could make a guitar sound and without, you know, without using any interior space. And he first he tried with a bass and tried to sell it to jazz musicians, and they weren't buying. And you can hear the Five Royales have several records where you can hear a Fender bass being played back in 1957, but it's really rare. But that, then, of course, the Ventures started up in the Northwest, and they used what I call electronic guitars. There was no acoustic space at all, and so these things began to be produced really cheaply, and that's how surf bands started. These, you know, let's do instrumentals. and you know, we'll make up things. We'll the Ventures were, they were really smart businessmen. They were putting out how to play the guitar books, and you know, you could learn to play all the Ventures hits, and then you just switch around a couple of notes and call it, you know, Beach Babe or something like that, and you could get some guy in L.A. to record you.
You know, it's interesting, the various things. Were you going to say something, Tracy?
I was just kind of surprised that that was coming from them. It's like, you know, as opposed to like maybe a record producer or a manager, that was coming
this
from them.
This is the big change that the books is setting you up for in Volume 2. Originally, you had to get the song to Wynonie Harris, and then the deal was worked out, and the A&R guy at the record company would tell Wynonie to record it. And that's how it worked. And the performer had nothing to do except to say, I can't sing this. This is awful. You know, well, okay, here's another one. You know, it's not like there was
that
a shortage.
Isn't quite as awful.
there was no shortage of material. But now it was the consumers who were making the repertoire. They were making the sound, and they were trying to get it out. And that's what the Beach Boys were all about. Their father had connections at Capitol Records. He also knew a husband and wife songwriting team who had a studio. And when his boys, when one of his boys, Dennis, went fishing with his cousin Mike Love, and he said, how come nobody's singing about surfing? we got all these instrumentals out there, but nobody's singing about what a gas it is, because Dennis was the only one of those guys who surfed. He brought it home, and he and Mike Love and his brother Brian made a record.
Just like that.
Yeah, in their garage.
Okay, we just last thoughts. We're okay. down to about a minute.
Last thoughts. Buy my book, please.
Well, that's a thought, but we can't actually ask people to do things. Well, we can say, you can buy my book.
You can.
It's what is called a call to action.
It's the greatest thing for Christmas, I tell you what.
But the book is The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 to 1963. By Ed Ward, and it's a wonderful book, and it would be a great Christmas present, even if you're just buying a Christmas present for yourself. So, okay.
Are you already farmed out? It's like volume two? Is that like already?
No, we
works?
Haven't started the negotiations for volume two. The publisher has said they definitely want it. So now we find out how much they want it.
Okay. How much they want it. All right. Okay, Edward, thank you very much for being with us on Rag Radio. I want to tell you what's coming up the next 2 weeks. Next Friday, our own Pedro Gatos, radio journalist and Cuba expert. He's a Latin American expert, has been to Cuba many, many times. And we're going to be talking about Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution, separating fact from fiction. Then on Friday, December 6th, renowned UT Austin astronomy professor Neil Evans, we're going to be and Austin astronomer Cecilia Colomé.
Oh, wow.
And we're going to be searching for extraterrestrial life. So we're still searching for terrestrial life.
I got some phone numbers, I think.
Well, thanks. We'll talk to you after the show.
Right.
So, okay. Are we set?
Yeah.
Tracy? I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio.